we could go grab some extra chairs. And in case you're asking, yes, the Public Utilities Commission Moving Company does hire out. And just give us a holler. Well, before we get started with the formal hearing tonight, I thought we'd probably just, number one, thank you all for coming. Obviously, we've packed the community room here, and I think that shows a lot of interest in this project. And we're looking forward to hearing more about the project from the applicant. I think it's also appropriate to let you know who we are. I'm Dusty Johnson. I'm a member of the Public Utilities Commission. And we've also got Commissioner Steve Kolbeck and Commissioner Gary Hansen here. And the three of us are the members of the Public Utilities Commission. We've got John Smith, who acts as our general counsel, and we also have Greg Rizlov, who acts as the commission's advisor. Now, aside from us, we've also got a number of folks who work for the Public Utilities Commission, but they don't really work for us. They work for the executive director, and they work for you all. They work for the public interest. And they are trying to determine what their recommendations will be to us as the deciders for this project. And we're going to go ahead and introduce them. I know we've got Martin Bettman in the back. We've got Kara Van Bockern. We have Bob Knadel. We have Nathan Solem. And so obviously thank you to them for their efforts. I should note tonight that we also have a court reporter. Her name is Sherry. And throughout the evening, if you're making comments, we would ask that you say your name, your town of residence, and then also make sure to speak slowly and clearly so that we can get all of your comments entered into the record. So with that, we're going to go ahead and we do have, you know, probably 3 or 5 minutes worth of legalistic stuff that we need to say to kick off this meeting, so we're going to go ahead and jump in. We will now begin the public input hearing for HP07-001, and that is, as you all know, the application by TransCanada Keystone Pipeline for a permit to construct the Keystone Pipeline Project. The date is, I believe, June 26, 2007, and the time is shortly after 7 o'clock in the p.m., and we're here in Clark. The purpose of this hearing is really twofold. The purpose is for the applicant, who is TransCanada, to provide information to us and to all of you about this project. That will probably answer a lot of questions that many of you have. It might also raise other questions in your mind after you hear some of the information. Then we move into the second half of the presentation of this meeting, and the purpose of that is really for you all to bring up any questions or concerns or comments you have about the project. And that is really for our benefit, the commissioner's benefit, so we know what sort of things we should be focused on as we move forward during this process. A copy of the application is on file with the Marshall, Day, Clark, Beadle, Kingsbury, Miner, Hansen, McCook, Hutchinson, and Yankton County auditors. The public may also access the application and all other documents in the file, non-confidential documents in the file, on the commission's website, and that's at www.puc.sd.gov. And there are some links you'll need to click on to get to this information. And if you need any help figuring out how to get that to get to that information, please ask any member of the Public Utilities Commission staff, and we would be happy to get you that information. Now, the parties to this proceeding at this time are the applicant, the Public Utilities Commission, and numerous other interested persons who've requested and been granted party status. Under South Dakota law, each municipality, county, and governmental agency in the area where the facility is proposed to be constructed, or any interested person or entity, may be granted party status in this proceeding by making written application to the commission on or before July 10th, 2007, and that is about 2 weeks away. I will take just a minute to explain party status. You know, I think what most of you probably want as a part of this process is an opportunity to make your concerns known and to get your questions answered. You don't need to do anything special to be a part of the process in that way. Really, at almost any time throughout this process, if you've got comments, and it doesn't have to be tonight, it can be next week, it can be next month, you can send the Public Utilities Commission a letter or an email, and we'll make sure that that gets entered into the official record. If you have questions, TransCanada has expressed a willingness to help answer those questions, and certainly at the commission, we're dedicated to getting you the answers that we have the information to. There are some people who want a lot more than that. Those people don't just want their questions answered. They don't just want, their concerns noted. They want to become formal legal parties to this proceeding. And that means you get the right to introduce evidence. That means you get to the right to object in a legal perspective during a more formal legal proceeding. You get an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses. You get an opportunity to call your own witnesses. You become subject to discovery. You yourself are able to, you know, issue discovery to other parties. It's a very formal legal part of the process. If you're looking to do that, you can fill out a form that says you want to be an intervener or to get party status, and we do have some of those forms here tonight. Some of you may have filled out those forms but have decided now you don't want to be in that deep. You don't want to be that legally that in deep. You just want to participate in these kind of proceedings. If that's the case, also let us know, and we can make sure that you go from being an intervener to an interested person, hundreds of people are. For the permit to be approved, the applicant must show that the proposed pipeline will comply with all applicable laws and rules, that the pipeline will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment or to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in the siting area, that the pipeline will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants, and that the pipeline will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region, with due consideration having been given to the views of governing bodies of local governments, of the local governments that are affected in this area. Based on these factors, the commission will decide whether the permit for the project should be granted, denied, or granted upon such terms, conditions, or modifications of the construction, operation, or maintenance of the facilities as the commission finds appropriate. We will now begin the hearing, or rather, I'll give you an outline for what we're looking at today. As I said, the applicant will go first. They will have about 45 minutes to present an informational presentation. After that, we've been doing commissioner questions, but we've had a number of commissioner questions. But because the meetings have been running a little long, the commissioners have agreed to set those aside, at least at the very outset, and give you all an opportunity to ask questions. And we may pick up and ask some questions as the evening goes along, if things occur to us. We do want to encourage landowners and anybody else here tonight to present your views, and again, you can submit your comments in writing to the commission. I hope everybody's had an opportunity to sign the sign-in sheet, and I saw almost everybody doing that in the back. You know, we've got, Bob, do you have the sign-in sheet? Okay, for those of you in the front who may not have heard Bob, we're going to start the sign-up sheet. You don't need to sign it a second time, but if you didn't get an opportunity to sign it the first time, please do sign it. That's really our record of who was here at this meeting, and we like to have that be as accurate as possible. This time I'm going to pause to see if my colleagues have noted anything that I've forgotten. With that, Mr. Brett Kennecke is an attorney from Peer, and he is counsel for TransCanada in this proceeding. Mr. Kennecke, why don't you introduce your team and take it away.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent TransCanada in this proceeding before the Public Utilities Commission. We appreciate the hospitality here in Clark. We appreciate the commission for putting these meetings together and giving notice of them. And we certainly most of all appreciate the turnout that we've gotten in the other communities and the meetings we held yesterday and certainly here tonight. Thank you very much. You're an important part of the process. We look forward, I think, as much as the commission, to hearing the input that you have to give as to the routing and the understanding and the all of the factors that the pipeline will have as it moves through South Dakota and provides oil to people, refineries south from here. So we do look forward very much to that. We've got a short, PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to be keeping better time on you guys tonight than maybe I did last night. I've got three gentlemen here who are going to be part of that presentation, and I have a number of other people seated behind them who happen to be experts, I think, in particular areas and will be assisting us in answering your questions as they come forward tonight. We'll do the best we can to answer those. We look forward to them. We look forward to the dialogue, and thank you very much. We've got Robert Jones. He's the Vice President for TransCanada in charge of the Keystone Project. Mike Koski is an engineer from Tallahassee, Florida, who I found out grew up in Thunder Bay, Ontario. And he's got overall responsibility as a contract engineer for the project. And Buster Gray, who's a pipeline engineer and has a specific responsibility for the design and construction of the pipeline. So they'll give you an overview of the process, and we look forward to the rest of the evening. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brett. And I would also like to thank you all for coming. It's a great turnout. The objective of the presentation for me is that you learn that TransCanada leads the industry in designing, constructing, and operating pipelines. We want to be here and responsive to answer your questions and any concerns you might have. This is a map of North America, and the dark lines and circles represent the assets that TransCanada has in North America. We're a leading North American energy infrastructure company. What does that mean? We are not an oil company. Keystone is a utility. We will be providing a service that is in the public interest. TransCanada has more than 36,500 miles of pipelines in North America. We have associated with those assets over 40,000 landowners along the 36,500 miles of pipe or various pumps, power facilities. We have over, we're also a power generator. We generate over 7,700 megawatts of power. We are, we have offices in Houston, Texas, Omaha, Nebraska, Portland, Oregon, throughout the United States. And you can tell by this map where they may be. I just also want to indicate that we have a project office in Kansas City, and that's where Buster's located. I think it's very important for us to understand why Keystone. Why is the pipeline routed through South Dakota? And the main reason can be really focused on this slide. Canada has 175 billion barrels of proven crude oil reserves and over 300 billion barrels of potential reserves. These reserves are only second to Saudi Arabia. And five of the six top countries with reserves are located in the Middle East. The U.S. economy consumes over 20 million barrels of crude oil every day in the refineries that are located here in the United States. Canada is today the largest supplier of crude oil. Approximately 2 million barrels of crude oil is supplied into the United States. After Canada is Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and then Mexico. The market for crude oil is refineries. That is where the product in the pipeline is heading to. And we need refineries to supply very valuable goods that we use every day. Gasoline for our cars, diesel for our trucks, fertilizer, lube oils, aviation fuel for the airplanes, and asphalt for the highways and roads. So Keystone is the vehicle to connect that enormous source of crude oil, that reliable source of crude oil just north of us, to the refineries that are located here in the U.S. And to prove that, we went out to the market and solicited contracts. U.S. and Canadian energy companies signed long-term binding contracts for 340,000 barrels per day to be sourced at the refineries that we are going to deliver to. I like to describe TransCanada as a trucker. We don't own the oil, we don't find the oil, and we don't make money selling the oil. We deliver the oil from Alberta to the refinery. The commercial premise for the project is to deliver initially to a refinery in Wood River and to source to refineries based out of Patoka, Illinois. We are planning an expansion, a 300-mile leg through Kansas and Oklahoma to source refineries in Cushing. And there's a number of refineries there. These refineries produce the products that are used here in South Dakota. Let me get into the details of the project itself. It's an 1,800-mile pipeline with 1,082 miles to be constructed in the U.S. The pipe is 30 inches in diameter, and it will be operated at a pressure of 1,440 psi. That's its maximum allowable pressure. At the initial capacity of around 435,000 barrels per day, the operating pressure in the pipe will be around 1,000 pounds per square inch. Like any good Canadian, the pipeline is designed like a hockey stick. The blade being an existing piece of natural gas pipeline that's going to be converted from gas to oil service. And that's why the pipeline goes across the prairies to Winnipeg. Then the shaft of the hockey stick would be the direct shot from Winnipeg through the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, towards Cushing, and then off through Missouri to Illinois. In order to move the oil through the pipeline, we're going to be using electric-driven pumps, and the pumps are located approximately every 50 miles. Federal and state regulatory review. Because Keystone crosses an international border, we need to get a presidential permit. To get a presidential permit, the lead agency in Washington is the Department of State, or DOS. The DOS is responsible for preparing an environmental impact statement, or an EIS, and that's under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. The project will also be reviewed by the Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife, and the Department of Transportation. Those are the federal agents. In South Dakota, the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facilities Act authorizes the siting and construction of the project. And part of that process is why we are here tonight. Other South Dakota agencies that have a role in reviewing this project include the Department of Environment and Natural Resources and the State Historic Preservation Office. We've been working on regulatory sitings and permits for almost 2 years, and our plan is to start construction in the spring of next year. The benefits to the residents of South Dakota. During construction, the facilities are going to have short-term benefits. The construction workers are going to need to go into the communities and buy food and use lodging. Along the right-of-way, they will also need to get local supplies, such as hardware, fuel, equipment, supplies for sand, gravel, and concrete. But the long-term benefits are the economic benefits to the local communities. And this comes in the form of property tax. It is estimated that Keystone will pay $6.5 million a year in its first year to the counties and school districts. In addition to the property tax, there's excise and contractor's tax. And this will come from the initial construction, and that is the benefit to the entire state. Permanent employees and temporary employees. Keystone has four pump stations in South Dakota that can be supported by two permanent journeyman electricians and a permanent journeyman pipeliner. But we're going to need 50 to 60 contract support staff to assist in the operation and maintenance of the pipeline, as well as support us in any emergency response. I'm now going to ask Mr. Mike Koski to come up and talk about route selection and environmental impact.
Thank you, Robert. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. I'd like to thank the commission and commission staff. It's great to have everybody here tonight. I'm just going to run through a high-level summary of the route selection process and environmental impact and mitigation issues associated with the proposed Keystone project. This is the facilities proposed in South Dakota. It's approximately 220 miles of 30-inch pipeline, four pump stations, and 15 mainline valves. Now, the route selection process involves a number of steps and a number of iterations associated with those steps. It's a multidisciplinary review involving engineering, environment, land, and biological resources. The first step in the process is to identify the project objectives, and that's basically what the project is to accomplish. And in this case, it's to bring oil from northern Alberta down to delivery points in Wood River, Illinois, and in Illinois, and at the initial part of the project was also included delivery points in Missouri. Now, that changed a bit as the process that Robert described went on and expressions of interest were received from shippers. And the second phase of the project involved adding deliveries in Oklahoma as a key objective of the project. Based on those project objectives, we established what we call control points, and those are places where the project must pass. Obviously, where the oil comes from is a control point, where it's going is a control point, and there's often points along the way where due to physical restrictions, such as a major river crossing or something, the line must pass. So that establishes the dots by which we determine the basic route for the project. Connecting those dots forms the area that we then study. We gather a lot of data. We gather desktop data. We gather aerial photography, mapping, GIS data. And we establish a number of what we call constraints and opportunities based on that data. Constraints being areas that we don't want to go or areas we want to minimize, and opportunities being areas that are favorable. Examples of constraints are very wet areas, poor soils, national parks, things such as that. Opportunities for us are usually existing linear facilities, such as existing pipelines, power lines. Those are often convenient features to follow. Now, South Dakota has a lot of pipelines in it. Unfortunately, none of them go exactly where we want to go. We have utilized some co-location opportunities with existing pipelines at a few key locations, most notably the Missouri River crossing at Yankton. Based on these constraints and opportunities, we then develop a series of alternatives. And that team that I mentioned of various disciplines gets together, reviews these alternatives, and comes up with a preferred alternative. Then we take that alternative out and we solicit input on it. We hold open houses, we gather input from the public, we take it to agencies, federal and state agencies, and gather information from there. We take that information and we circle back through this whole process again, and through the course of years, it's been a couple years now, we arrive at a preferred route, which we then submit for consideration in the regulatory process. Now, we certainly heard recently a lot of suggestions that we might want to follow I-29 with the route in North and South Dakota. Now, at first thought, that seems to make a lot of sense. It's an existing linear facility. It's not where we necessarily want to go, but it's certainly along in a path parallel to where we want to go. So, and we actually did evaluate that alternative very early on. I mentioned there was two basic phases in the development of the project. One, when we were going to Missouri and Illinois, and at that time, we did evaluate an alternative alongside I-29. That involved, at that time, we were also going through the state of Iowa. There's basically two ways with which I-29 could potentially be utilized as a co-location opportunity. Either within the existing highway right-of-way or adjacent to it. We never considered being in the right-of-way. The right-of-way doesn't afford sufficient room for normal pipeline construction. The interstate, as everybody knows, involves a lot of interchanges and overpasses. Each one of those requires us to deviate around. And also, there tends to be a lot of towns and cities along the interstate. That's the reason the interstate's there. And those become areas we have to route around. So the result is you end up being outside of the right-of-way, and again, you're on private landowners. And because of all the deviations associated with interchanges and overpasses and cities, the route ends up being longer, and you end up impacting more landowners and more of the environment. Other concerns with being within the right-of-way include safety with traffic and for construction workers, and also it serves as an impediment to highway expansion and maintenance. So when we did evaluate an alternative alongside I-29, it was alongside it, and we rejected it for largely similar reasons. Even though we're alongside it, we're still involving interchanges, still involving overpasses and cities, and we would have to go around everything, and it just gets longer, impacts more private landowners. And when the project objectives changed to include deliveries in Oklahoma, this then required the project to go further south before it could go east to Oklahoma or go east to Illinois. This required a crossing of the Missouri River. Now, as everybody knows, the Missouri River is a fairly large crossing. It's not something that you can just do anywhere. And we spent a lot of time evaluating crossing options and landed on a crossing at Yankton, South Dakota, where there are two existing pipeline crossings as an ideal location. So based on a crossing of the Missouri River here and an entry into the U.S. up here, that places us 35 to 40 miles west of I-29. This point here is relatively fixed by, as Robert had mentioned, there was a desire to utilize this existing gas line and convert it to oil in Canada. And that puts us at a crossing point here. So that basically puts us west of I-29. And to use portions of I-29 now would require diverting over to I-29 and then coming back, again adding even more length to it. Now, as far as environmental review for the project, as Robert mentioned, the project comes under jurisdiction of the Department of State. Department of State is the nominated lead federal agency for the NEPA process, and they are currently preparing an EIS. There are other cooperating federal agencies that are participating in that review. In support of that, of the application that initiated the NEPA review, Keystone has filed extensive environmental data gathered both desktop and through a fairly massive field survey program. A lot of you have probably asked for survey permission at various points over the last year, and that was all part of supporting this application. There's wetland surveys, cultural surveys. All of that has been submitted in support of that application. And all that information has also been submitted in support of the South Dakota PUC application. And the summary of impacts associated with the project are provided in the PUC application, and they address all major resource areas. Now, as far as mitigation of impact, a key component of Keystone's mitigation plan is the Construction Mitigation and Reclamation Plan. This plan is a set of rules and specifications of how we construct the project, and this includes procedures for crossing farmland, for crossing water bodies, wetlands, and very importantly, the reclamation of all these lands crossed and the monitoring after construction to ensure that that reclamation was sufficient. This plan was put together. It's attached to all of our applications at various federal and state permitting levels and will become part of our approvals, and is something that we will be bound by as we construct and operate the project. With that, I'd like to ask Buster Gray to come up and talk a little bit about land acquisition and construction.
Good evening. I think I have seen a few of the folks here from some previous meetings, so maybe some of this will be repetitive to you. We're asking for a 110-foot construction right-of-way that's comprised of a 50-foot permanent easement and a 60-foot temporary easement, and that's the typical workspace and permanent easement that we would be asking for on a particular landowner's tract of land. You would also see additional temporary workspaces like at road crossings and streams and rivers, to where we typically have to move more dirt or spoil, and we need areas to store that on. If we go to the next slide, isn't it? But many of the folks here, you may have been contacted so far about land acquisition. You may not have. We started about 2 months ago here in South Dakota acquiring right-of-way, and we're in that process. If you have not been contacted as of today, I would suggest to you maybe within the next few weeks to a month that you would be contacted. The comment that I want to make about our compensation policy for right-of-way is That is to play fair market value for the permanent easement, the 50-foot that I described previously, 50% of fair market value for the temporary workspace, and a crop loss program that is based on 100% of the first year's crop loss, the year of construction. And when I say 100% of crop loss, that is 100% of the yield that you would get off of that strip of land as if you had not planted it would be how that is calculated. Then the second year or the year following construction, that would be at a 75%, and the third year that would be at 50%. But still closer, I'm sorry. The other item that we bring forward, the easement agreement has some restrictions about building structures or doing some things in it. But as far as agricultural production, we would return the land for your use and enjoyment of growing crops over it. We feel strongly we can restore the land to the production that you have at the current time over time after our compensation program. We've had some issues brought forth to us concerning maybe land agents, how they're interfacing with landowners. And one, our policy is to treat with respect, fairness, explain the process, not to strong arm, not to use any tactics. These are some contact numbers, and they're also in the literature that are on the table. But our South Dakota office is in Huron. Tim Slorby is who would you would contact. In Kansas City, there's a gentleman named Denny Needham. And then here this evening, Sandra Roth, that's here with TransCanada. If you have complaints about the performance of our agents or how they interact, if you'll contact these offices, we will investigate those issues, and we will investigate them, and we will take actions accordingly. The next slide is kind of a graphic representation of a pipeline construction operation. And this graphic representation starts with initial crews from surveying and clearing operations to, as you see, it snakes around to the back-end crews, which are backfill, cleanup, and testing. This assembly line is similar to how cars are built, is that indeed workers move along this product and move in crews along it, much like an automobile factory. The workers stay stationary and the cars or the equipment moves by them. The characteristics of this construction spread would be about 350 to 450 construction workers. The initial crews from front end to back end, weather always is a factor in our work, but you could expect it to be about 50 to 60 miles. The all of the crews will move at a pace of about 1 to 1.25 to 1.5 miles per day of construction. So the construction goes relatively rapidly. One other comment we make to you, again, weather dependent, is we believe the typical landowner will be impacted about 8 to 12 weeks from the front cruise to the last cruise. The next group of slides that you'll see, I've gone through and tried to put some slides in here of some of the assembly line that I've just talked about, and I'll try and run through these very quickly to it. But topsoil preservation and the return of topsoil and is when I talked about returning the land to its productivity. Our initial crews, based on your requirements, we will remove topsoil to your requirements, and we will salvage and store the topsoil for returning at the completion of construction. Some of the next operations are from pipe yards that are located along the particular pipeline route. We will haul pipe from those to the right-of-way. We call the operation stringing, and we string the pipe along the right-of-way. The pipe, as you'll notice in the other photograph, for horizontal turns or great vertical turns, we literally have to bend the pipe to the topography of the earth, and we have hydraulic machines that will do that. The next operation of excavation, whether it's wheel trenchers or backhoes, would be the two methods. It's my belief that kind of the southern half of South Dakota would be more likely by trenching machines, maybe the northern portions by backhoe simply because of wetter conditions. Our nest operations, where we weld the joints of pipe together, we typically do it by either automatic or manual welding, two different techniques. All welds are inspected for to meet code compliance, and any defects that are found are removed prior to the completion of the pipeline. The weld joints have to be coated. The pipe comes from the mills with a factory-applied coating, but the weld joints, we can't bring it. We have to coat those in the field, and we typically coat them with either a spray-applied or brush-applied coating. The coatings are inspected with a device called a Jeep, and it's an electric device. We run down the pipe, and if you have an anomaly, it makes a sound, and you literally will patch those places before the pipe's picked up and lowered into the trench. Our nest operations are padding and backfill. If we have material we're not satisfied with as far as it having rock or angular granular material, we'll pad the pipe. We typically do that with machines that will sort the backfill to take the fines out, put the fines around the pipe before we put the remainder of the spoil. But typically, all of the material that goes back into the trench is what the material that came out. I talked about topsoil replacement, and certainly in areas where you have a distinction, you can see that there's a significant distinction in subsoil and topsoil in these slides, and we make a concerted effort to return it to the contour as best we can with the equipment that we work with. Foreign or other utilities, as we call them, whether it's fiber optic cables, water lines, other pipelines, we typically go through a process of contacting, acquiring those requirements from those companies, and typically we have a 12-inch spacing between our pipe and some other existing utility. I say that's not just a public utility, that's private utilities as well. If you have private water lines or private electric lines, if they're identified, we will typically cross beneath them, but occasionally we would ask you to cut one. Road crossings, we'll typically both bore, certainly all paved roads, all well-maintained and travel roads. We have found in the Dakotas that sometimes there are township roads that are not maintained, and I call them like two-track roads. We might ask permission to open cut those, but they would be on a case-by-case basis. All right. Once the pipeline's completed, we fill it with water and test it to 125% of its operating pressure, and those records are maintained for the life of the pipeline. This device is a caliper pig or a geometry device that we check the pipe for any dents or buckles or wrinkles from transportation and construction prior to putting the pipe in service. And reclamation, restoring your land is very important. These photographs, decompaction, our heavy equipment moving along the right-of-way is our biggest concern, and ripping and then reseeding to prevent erosion and picking up of rock, much as you have with the glacial till here. And this photograph just represents a construction and post-construction. The comment being is we can restore the right-of-way and the lands in it, but we cannot restore it to its original condition. We will make every effort to return it to its productivity, but we do not profess that it'll be identical to when we left or when we arrived. Sorry. There you go. Back to Robert.
Just a few more slides to conclude. How are we doing for time? 10 minutes? Good. Keystone is subject to compliance with federal regulators and state agencies. Regulations are intended to ensure protection of the public and the environment and the workers, and we and also regulations are there to prevent failures. One of the things I'm very proud of TransCanada is our ability to design pipelines. We're leading in this effort to minimize the risk of damage. The pipeline, top of the pipeline, it will be 48 inches from the top of the surface of the ground to the top of the pipe. Code is 30 inches, so we're 18 inches deeper than the standard of the industry. We also use a very high-strength steel. Over the years, the technology in steels has improved, and Keystone and TransCanada have always used high-strength steel materials. One of the greatest advances in technology over the years has been the external coating. This protective coating is a fusion bond epoxy. Sometimes it's referred to as FBE. The fusion bond epoxy coating comes right out of the mill. The pipe is sandblasted to a pure white finish and then is heated, and an epoxy is sprayed onto the pipe and fuses right to the steel. If there is any damage to the coatings or the field coating, as Buster described, we also have a backup, and that is the cathodic protection. And that's a low-voltage electric current that is applied to the pipeline, as shown in this diagram. In areas where we cross either a railway or a highway, we put up marker signs, and there's also warning tape. Isolation valves are located strategically along the pipeline. I believe there's 15 in South Dakota, and that is to unlike the event of a leak or a spill, it is to minimize the volume of discharge. These design features are best practices. Keystone's design exceeds or meets all the code requirements. Last night, I just want to make a clarification. I indicated that TransCanada had never had a leak on any pipe that we built since 1980. That is specific to external corrosion, so I want to make that clarification for the record. Construction safety features. TransCanada has developed, over its 50 years of experience, a quality control and a quality assurance program. It begins with the manufacture of the pipe, and that has to do with the manufacture of the steel. And we go right into the plant with our inspectors and our national code requirements to ensure that the quality of the steel is first exceeds standard, and then we inspect the fabrication of the pipe, and we inspect the delivery right to site. And, of course, Buster has described all the QA, QC activities that occur during construction. But it doesn't end there, and it continues through operation. During operation, we have a control center, a computerized, they call it SCADA, computer system. This system runs 24 hours a day, 365 days a week, and we have a backup system, a backup control center to this system. So if there's something that goes down with the main control center, we immediately have the backup control center. We also have redundant communication. So not only do we have a primary communication source to make sure that we have the signals, we have the backup. We also have a dedicated leak detection system. This leak detection system is based on a computerized model, and it measures the volume of crude oil that comes into the pipeline and the volume of crude oil coming out of the pipeline constantly, so we can make sure that the volumes match. Pipeline maintenance. So TransCanada, over its many years of experience, has developed an integrity management program that has been extremely successful, and it meets or exceeds all federal requirements. This picture here describes an inline inspection tool, sometimes referred to them as smart pigs. These are computerized devices that can measure changes in the pipe wall thickness and also can measure any deformations in the welds. Keystone is planning to run this smart pig in the system within 3 years of operation. Once we receive that data, we will, if we find any anomaly, we will investigate that site, and if we find it, there is a defect, we'll repair it immediately. We also participate in a variety of public awareness programs to make sure the public is aware, because we certainly don't want anybody to inadvertently dig up the pipeline and strike it. So we will participate in the South Dakota One Call program. Oil spill response. Keystone will be submitting a detailed oil spill response to the to PHMSA prior to commencement of operation. The spill response and cleanup equipment will be strategically located and will be pre-positioned prior to operation, and is based on the worst case potential discharge. In the unlikely event of a spill or a leak, Keystone will remediate the area. And we will do that in coordination with not only federal regulators, but the state of South Dakota, DENR. Our commitment. TransCanada has worked very hard over the years in all the communities that we have a presence. And we do that by respecting not only our landowners, but our employees and our contractors and the safety, the health and safety of those folks, and we want to protect the environment. We look forward to being a good neighbor and part of the community here in South Dakota. To communicate with the stakeholders, TransCanada has a website, the Keystone website. We also have a 1-800 number. And I think Buster's given you the different numbers for our land agents as well. So I'm hoping that concludes our presentation, and I hope that we've done a good we've been able to inform you on more about TransCanada and certainly more about Keystone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Kennecke. This is actually the third of four public hearings that the Commission is having this week. We started yesterday in Yankton, and then last night we were in Alexandria, and tomorrow we'll be in Britton. So the commissioners have had opportunities to ask the applicant a number of questions. And also, this is really just the beginning of this process. It may be that further down the line, this will become a more formalized hearing process where there'll be evidence and witnesses who are sworn. Their testimony would be under oath. That's not what we're doing tonight. And so we're going to go ahead and instead of having commissioners ask questions, we're going to open it up to you all. We do have a few requests. At a meeting that the commission had a couple of weeks ago, we did try to figure out how could we make this most useful so we could hear from the most people possible and get as much information as we could at these public meetings. As a result, we'd like to have people who have brief comments go first. It may be that some of you have got a lot to do at home or on the farm tonight, and rather than make you wait behind four or five people who might have a really long presentation or a series of questions, we want to give you the opportunity to go first. So if you've got, 1 or 2 or 3 minutes worth of comments or questions, we want to hear from you first. We'd also ask that you not read off a whole list of questions, or that you not ask it, that you not pepper 5 or 6 out in quick succession, because it's really difficult for us to make sure that the applicant answers all of those questions. So start with a couple. We'll make sure that we get those fully answered, and then we can come back to you and make sure that we get the rest of your questions answered. Again, I'd ask that, we would ask that you, when you get to the microphone, state your name, tell us where you're from, and then make sure to speak up. Now, Sherry, our court reporter, in the last couple of public hearings, there have been a number of instances where she just had to stop somebody and say, hey, can you say your name again, or can you spell your name? And so please be cognizant of that and speak slowly and loudly. We do have a microphone which is cordless. And so if you'd like, just raise your hand, and Ms. Van Bakkeren, at least for the first shift, will be bebopping all around making sure we get that mic to you. This is tough because there are a lot of issues, there are a lot of questions that people have about TransCanada. We'd like if you could stay focused to this project and to the extent possible stay focused on what the Commission's authority is over this project. Sometimes people have questions about eminent domain and maybe some of those can come up tonight, but we also think it's important that you realize the Public Utilities Commission doesn't doesn't have anything to do with eminent domain. That's a court issue that this commission is not going to have any ability to weigh in on. Other things like landowner treatment, if you've got questions, it's fine to ask them. But it's probably a little more fruitful if we stay focused on the commission's authority. I'd also ask that people, you know, if a question's been asked or if a comment's been made, try not to be repetitive. You can say, you know, I actually agree with that guy in the red tie who brought up that issue about his cattle. That's great. But if we could try to cut down the repetitiveness, I think we'll be able to hear from as many people as possible. And finally, another request we would have is that if people have given presentations at past meetings yesterday, or if they're planning to give a presentation tomorrow, that you not do it here. We'd like to hear from as many people rather than hearing from the same people many times. With that, have I forgotten anything? Oh, yeah. From time to time, we'll need to take breaks. A court reporter isn't able to go for hours and hours without stopping, and so we want to make sure that we can give her the rest that she needs. And actually, they end up being beneficial because sometimes there are questions you all have that maybe aren't good for the entire crew, that are more of a unique perspective to you, and that'll give you an opportunity to grab the applicant, some of their staff members, and make sure you get those questions answered. Anything else I've forgotten? With that, let's go ahead and...